How'd you get from the Phillies to the Reds?
How did I get from the Phillies to the Reds? I couldn't get anybody out. I hurt my arm in 52. Okay, I didn't hurt it. I came to spring training wide open after my 1951 season. Mm-hmm. And I worked, and we worked, and everything was fine, and I was in as good a shape as I'd ever, you know, we always got in shape during spring training. I got through with my work in a cold, damp, drizzly day, and I'm hot and all this sort of stuff, and I start to the clubhouse to go in, and we go in and take a quick shower and put on drawers and put on dry clothes and let Frank Wechek, the trainer, rub us down with alcohol. But a baseball fan from Allentown, Pennsylvania named Ike Eichelberg stopped me. His first day he was there, and I'm going to put about it. He said, "How's your wife? And how are you babies? How are you children?" I stood out there and talked to him for 20 minutes. And I felt myself getting colder and colder and colder and cooler. Next morning, Rick, I couldn't brush my teeth. I tried to run it out. Tried to throw it out, got frustrated, got mad, whatever, all the emotions you go through. And I just, there was no velocity, there was no nothing. I had this terrible thing under my shoulder blade. But I, being, you know, that era and whatever, you try to throw it out and run it out. It didn't come out. And then I got very disgruntled and all this sort of stuff, and they traded me to Cincinnati for a left-handed pitcher named Kent Peterson and Johnny Y. Roston, who had played there.
What did you think about leaving Philly?
Bad. It was like being outcast from your family. But went to Philadelphia went to Cincinnati. And it was a different attitude and a different place. And I said this at one of our things up there. I said, the first time I was ever second guessed in my life in the first ball game I ever pitched in Cincinnati. Luke Sewell is from Alabama, and he was the manager. And Chapman was his coach. Simonick was there. And the first inning I pitched, I came in, got the people out and all that sort of stuff, and still not throwing real good. Luke asked me, he said, what'll it do to get you back? I said, give me the ball every 4 days and let me get routine. Just let me get routine. First inning, I'm pitching the inning and all this sort of, Luke was the catcher. Then I came in and he said, what'd you throw that pitch for? And I said, because I thought that's the pitch I could get him out on. He said, oh. So I sat there and it took me a total of 10 seconds to realize this is the first goddamn time in my baseball career that anybody has ever questioned a pitch I threw. We were not taught that way. Throw the pitch you think and get somebody out on it. I'm sorry. It's still insensitive. And it was true. It was true. First time I'd ever been second-guessed in my life. It didn't put questions in my mind. I just looked at old Luke, and then I watched things that went on and all this sort of stuff. And instead of, your third baseman getting up in front of third base and blocking the thing, instead of your catcher blocking the home plate, instead of everybody going 100% until the play's over and this sort of stuff, I was on a sixth-place ball club. And then I didn't really like it. And then they fired Luke, and then Hornsby came in. And I'll say this now, I said it before, and I'll say it right now, and you can quote me. That was the worst manager God ever put on this earth, and the most uncaring son of a bitch about a baseball player that God ever put on this earth. He might have been the greatest second baseman in the world, the greatest hitter, but he knew nothing about baseball players. And that's all I got to say about Orange. Needless to say, my stay in Cincinnati was very short.
Will Horace Bamp spend all his time playing the ponies or what?
I don't know.
Yeah, no, he had a gambling problem.
I don't know anything about his personal life.
He didn't drink and he didn't smoke. He wouldn't go to the movies during the season because it bothered his eyes. But
he sat in the all I ever saw of Hornsby was
sat in the lobby, right?
How much of stuff are you gonna Clint and talk about? Well, I'm gonna tell you exactly what I think.
Well, that's what I'm here for.
Okay.
That's what I want to hear.
I called Hornsby rotten crotch. Hornsby would go through a baseball game. Baseball game be over. He was first one in the shower. And he'd be out of the shower and if he stayed in the shower 3 minutes, fine. Wipe himself off, dry himself off, reach up in his locker and get a bottle of Vaseline. Vaseline. A big, big bottle of Vaseline. Get two fingers full of it, spread his legs out, reach between his, under his in his crotch, started his balls, and first time I saw it, I said, rotten crotch. And everybody on the Cincinnati Ball Club called him rotten crotch. And put on his clothes, and he's gone. He's gone. Now, on the other side of the coin, we had two daughters that were 53, so that means they were 3 and 2 in spring training. Hornsby was one of the nicest, most considerate people in the world to those two daughters of ours. He never acknowledged a wife. He never acknowledged a ball player. But the little girls and the little kids, he was like you think people ought to be.
I've got two books that he wrote, My War with Baseball and My Kind of Baseball, both of those at home, and that's mentioned in both of those that he's very good with kids but not very good with adults. They said he used to run a baseball camp, I guess, down in Arkansas or something like that. I guess the kids just raved about him.
I got him since the torn began. They had a guy in Brooklyn named Pat. And I got the name Pat Patterson of PA announcer that announced the names and numbers of the ball players. And he had been there forever. And just, you know, he made it the point to come over and know your number and know your name and talk and be congenial and what have you. And he was a Brooklyn fan. If you cut him, he'd bleed blue and all this sort of stuff. But first trip into Brooklyn, he came over. And he said, Roger, it's nice to have you back in the National League. Horns was sitting on the bench and he said, my name is Rogers Hornsby. And it just totally, I just saw him just, I was pitching that day. And later on, I'd be the first one to say, I had no respect for the man as a manager of baseball, not only what his attitude toward pitchers. He thought a pitcher could go pitch every day. He didn't know how to use pitchers. He would work. He wanted people to, you know, go out and come out, and he was going to teach them baseball, and these people been in the major, been in the majors 4 or 5 years. They knew how to play baseball. But something came up, I don't know where it was, and we might have been in Brooklyn. We might have been, I don't know where we were, but I hear this, he had a very commanding voice, and he said, hey, Bubber. And I stopped in my tracks, and I said, my name is Bubba, B-U-B-B-A. And don't you forget it, Roger. Frank Smith was one of our, needless to say, I was gone very soon, which I took a second to get gone. But no, Frank Smith was one of our relief pitchers and a damn good one, and he's still there, and I see him occasionally at different functions and what have you. And he says, "Hey, Bubber." you know, baseball was fun.
We were at the Reds when Brooklyn sent had 19 straight guys get on base. Were you at the Reds tonight? Or was that?
No, it wasn't the Braves. You said the Braves?
No, the Brooklyn Dodgers.
No.
You weren't with the Reds when that happened?
No, I was with the Reds when Hornsby was managing, and we played in Milwaukee, and Mac Zircunt struck out 8 hitters in a row.
Mm-hmm.
Because Zircunt had played for Hornsby, and he knew exactly what he was going to do, and he had to take them. Mac Zircunt struck out 8 hitters in a row. But I don't remember the 19.
No, Brooklyn had 19 guys in a row of each first base. Obviously, that's some sort of record. But anyway, I was with
Cincinnati when what was right-handed pitcher? We were playing the Giants. He walked 21 hitters in the polo grounds.
When you were with the Reds real early in 53, this is really a baseball question, but I'm just curious. The Reds, because of Joe McCarthy and what was going on with communism, changed their name from Reds to Red Legs.
I don't remember that.
Remember that?
It was always Cincinnati Reds. And I don't remember that. Of course, I was less interested in politics then, but I don't know. But I do remember they changed their name to the Red Legs. But
so you and Roger or Rogers had a falling out, and then you wanted.
No, it was not a falling out. When he first got there, he had everybody come to the ballpark at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And it's hot in Cincinnati. And the ballpark was down in a sort of it was low. And it was close to that river.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon in Cincinnati in June, July, it's hot. And he was going to position people and, you know, get his line on people, I guess. My experiences tell me that a new manager comes in, unless he's walking into something real good, and anyway, the guy inherited the 6th place ball club.
He'd just been fired by the Browns, I think. So.
Oh, something. So I don't really know, because I knew his name and this sort of stuff. But he had us out there, and he had pitchers working every day, and I was just getting into a groove and getting routine and this sort of stuff, and here comes Hornsby, and he wanted me to pitch every day. Start or relieve. Short relief, long relief, that's before you ever heard of it in your life. And I did not want to be, and I never was, a relief pitcher. I had to get myself routine, and I could pitch you pitch a third day, I pitch a fourth day, something like that, but hell, I was routine. And my arm, I threw the curveball, and I threw the fastball, and I needed a couple of days to, you know, just go do what my routine. But he wanted all of his pitchers thrown every day so he could evaluate him. Now, he's got Krasuski, who Ted is a Polish guy, and weighed about 210, 220, something like that. And Polish people believe in drinking beer, and Ted, you know, do his work and all this sort of stuff, but hell, they had, what was it, what's the beer in?
Hudepo.
Hudepo. Had Hudepo beer. Wehmeyer, Ted, and those people grew up on beer. We grew up on water and milk. I didn't like beer. But go out there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and Hornsby wanted to keep the intel out there working. And Ted just, you know, after so long time, he just walked off first base. Hornsby said, "Where are you going?" He said, "I'm going to the clubhouse. I got a ball game to play tonight." Hornsby said, "Get back out there to first base." Ted said, "I'll be there tonight. Ball game." and he walked. Hornsby never said, because he might have said something, but nothing was ever said about it. And it was not rebellion or anything like that, but everybody's trying to keep a job. But I said, the only way I know how to put it, I said, I ain't playing for this son of a bitch. And I'd go anywhere in the world. This man knows nothing. He has no compassion for anybody. He doesn't know anything about men. Now, bear in mind, I got 120 people through India and Burma for 2.5 years, and every one of us came home alive. And this man sitting up here playing our life's game, what we really want to do, and he don't give a damn whether you do or don't. I'm sorry. I didn't like him when he's alive, and I don't like him when he's dead.
There are a lot of people that feel the same way you do. In 54 and 55, how come you spent both those years out in the Pacific Coast League?
Well, I was told, I was traded to Chicago, and I went over there, and Phil Cavaretta was the manager, and I had pitched against Phil, and Phil gave me the ball. I won 4 in the first ball games I pitched over there. And then I don't know what it was, but next thing I know, I'm on my way. Whit Matthews was the general manager, and he wanted me to relieve. And I was never a relief pitcher. And I had a couple of failures in relief. And one success I had, I came in relief and threw one pitch, and they hit a double play, and next inning we win the ball game in the bottom of the ninth. So I win a ball game with one pitch. But I was told that Mr. Wrigley wanted a winner in L.A. And I had the contract.
More than he wanted one in Chicago, huh?
Yeah. He was going to draw his million. This is my opinion, and my opinion only. But I was told by Whit Matthews that Mr. Wrigley wanted me to go to L.A. because he wanted to win around there, and you need more pitching time and what have you, and get more there. And I could say a lot more, which I won't say, because every time we went to Polo Grounds and went to Brooklyn, some of our pitchers got sick. I mean, I won't name names, but they got sick. They just, by God, got sick. That's all they did. Thank heavens I pitched in Brooklyn when one of them got sick and beat Brooklyn 3-2 in 1954 or 55. My wife was sitting right there in the damn stands watching. In fact, the guy sitting, I gave her the ball, and the guy sitting behind it said, you worked harder than he did. But anyway, that's one of those asides. But I went to L.A., and I won 11 and lost 6 or 7 from the time I went out there till it was all over. And next year, same thing, and they fired Cavaretta and hired Hack.
Yeah.
And I was told the same thing. Still had the contract, so I went out begrudgingly. I wanted time in the majors. And, I went out there and won 10 or 11 and lost 6 or 7 again. I had a guy named Bill Sweeney that was managing out there, and the next year, what the hell was the big old catcher's name? So anyway, one of the Cubs, people, they're the organization people. And I had a good year for him. Came on, I told him, I won't be back. So they traded me to some Sacramento, and here I am, and I got a wife, and I got 3 kids, and all I can see is Cal MacLeish went out to L.A. They traded him to San Diego. He stayed out there about 6 years. Could have pitched in the majors anywhere, anytime. But he stayed out there for 6 years, and all I could see was Cal, Cal, Cal. And I said, I'm not going to do it. And I didn't do it. And I said, I'm out of here. I went to Columbus, Ohio, it was a major league meeting, and the Giants tried to get my contract. Carpenter tried to get my contract. And Mr. Matthews says, no, we won't trade him. And you know what I told Matthews? I said, you're gonna eat it, because I'm through. Oh, you ain't gonna quit. I said, you're gonna eat it. So he ate it, and I stayed out a year.
What'd you do that year?
Learned a new profession. You got three kids, and all you know is baseball.
Yeah.
I went in the real estate business as a salesman, and real estate market real good, and then the damn recession hit. And I called Carpenter, and he got me, and I went to Miami and pitched down there and coached for a year or two, and it was all over.
You talked about Satchel Paige down in Miami, and I was going to ask you about that, but somebody else is down in Miami that I have to ask you about. I have to ask you about Tiger. Tiger with the singing dog.
My dog?
Yeah.
How did you hear about my dog?
This is the Society for American Baseball Research, and I did my research and found out about your dog.
Oh, my God.
You'd take him to the park, and he'd sing the national anthem?
Oh, man, alive, let me tell you something. Yeah, I wish you could talk to this kid that just called me, this daughter just called me, because they were 58, so that means she was 57, 58.
She was 7 or 8.
And I got that Doberman, that was given to me by my brother-in-law in 1951. And she went every mile that we went. And when I went to Miami, carried my wife, my three children, and the Doberman down there with me. I wish I had the picture of her. Hell, I've got a picture of her right here. She lived 17 years, and I guess you can do things in the minors that you can't do in the majors, but I would take her to the ballpark with me so she could run.
Mm-hmm.
And when the ball game started, take her in the bullpen, she'd be in the bullpen, and they played the national anthem.
Miss Tiger.
And when they played the national anthem, I'm telling you, too, she would just sit there and just sing. And people just sort of looked forward to her singing. And it was a joke. I didn't know y'all knew anything about that.
Yeah, was she good?
Oh, hell no, she couldn't sing. She's just howling. But people in Miami didn't mind so much. And, it embarrassed hell out of me for a little while until they told me how much they enjoyed the dog down there. And she'd be in the bullpen and just be the nice, docile thing she was and go home and just do what she did. But God Almighty, I didn't know y'all.
Well, go ahead.
No, I just thought she was great. We had her 17 years.
Yeah.
17 years that dog lived. And when she got to bed, I said, a friend of mine said, I got a farm, said, let's bring her out there. And the baby told me, said, the only way she's going to live any longer is get her out somewhere, you know. So she lived about 3 or 4 months, and the guy called me and said, we lost old Lou. Said, I found her under the trailer, and she just sound asleep. And you know how long it took me to tell the kids? Took me 3 months. I wouldn't tell them.
Wow.
I know, she's just as much part of this family as those kids were.
I like that story. Took the dog to the ballpark. In 54, I have to ask you about this, because after what happened between you and Klosowski, did you get your nose broke that year by a line drive?
No, not me. Nothing. No, it's been this big all my life, and I've got something growing on it right now, and none of us know what it is.
I don't know where I read that, but I'm gonna have to look that one up again and see.
My nose has never been broken.
Okay. Well, somebody's got that in error.
Because Ted came closer to it than anybody else, and he hit the line right back in here. Because he laid this eyelid right here. but my nose never got broke.
Well, that was in 54 I read about that, so I'll check that out and I'll send that back to you wherever I got that from.
That's wrong. I never had a broken nose.
Your pitch of motion, is that something you just picked up on your own, or did you copy anybody else, or that was all yours?
I was born with great balance. No, it was mine. Of course, I watched other people. I didn't emulate other people, but it didn't take very long watching Harry Burkeen and watching his motion. And, you know, pitching is nothing in the world but deception. And we wore sleeves that hung down to here. Harry Burkeen would cut his, and that damn thing would be hanging down to here somewhere. But not really and clearly. It's all balance and leg lift and patience, and I learned in the International League, and I don't know where I learned it or how I learned it, but if you use the same motion, you can get clocked. So I had the balance that I could do what Paige is talking about. Get your leg up here, and we were taught to take the glove, use the glove, throw the glove here, and then come from here, you know. And, no, God was good to me. I had good balance and good rhythm, and most of all, balance, because that's what pitching is balance.
Nowadays, there seems to be 5, 6, I don't know how many coaches the Indians had this year, you know, being from up around Cleveland. It seemed like there's a bench coach, and there's two bullpen coaches, this, that, and the other. What kind of instruction did you guys get when you were playing, either in spring training or during the year? Did the coaches help at all, or were they just...
No, well, we watched each other. And we really and truly watched, and the coaches, you know, of course, the coaches studied you, and bear in mind that our coaches, I'm talking about the Philly coaches, Benny Ben Guy, Cy Perkins, Kenny Silvestri. Then you get to the other ball club that I played on, and they're second division ball club, and it was not criticism, it was not critiquing, it was find a flaw, something that you're unconsciously doing, and point that out to you. And I know that I pitched all 1 year, and I was going to throw the curveball. I'd come here, back here. When I was going to throw the fastball, I'd come here. I didn't know that. One of the coaches, the Pittsburgh Pirates, told me at the end of the year in 1950, he said, "Bubba, you got to correct it." He said, "We know every time you're going to throw a curveball." So I must have had a pretty good curveball, because they didn't, you know.
They had a pretty good year.
Had a good year, but he said, "Bubba, you're coming back here with a curveball, and you're coming here with a fastball." And click, I mean, I'm talking about coming from the bullpen to the bench, because I had gone down the bullpen to sit in the bullpen, just did a little bit of work, and watch the ball game. And God Almighty, I said, "You're right." So now then, instead of coming back here, you come here, you try to get the same effect. But that's what baseball was then. You know. And we could watch each other. And all baseball, all pitching is this is my left leg. I'm gonna take my left leg, and I'm gonna get my. Hell, I can show you better. You're gonna come here. Then we could pump. You know, we could get here, and I could stand out there and just pump, and then come here. And all it is just come here, get your hand down, throw the glove, but most of all, the most important thing of all, is this left foot. Is pointing towards home plate and balance, and then go on and get your balance and make your pitch, throw your pitch. And now then, they stand here like this. And they do this and throw a little bitty baseball for 3 or 4 innings. And then they come by somebody else.
Yeah.
But just go back to go back to Larry Jensen. Go back to Preacher Row. The patience. And I promise you, if you look at film, you'll see every pitcher back then, except some of the power pitchers like Newton. You watch Robbie pitch, you watch Simmons pitch, I don't care what they do with their motion. When they come here, that foot is home plate. He'll hit the ground first, make the pitch. And you show kids this all year long, and you'll see them here, you see them here. But that's what pitchers is, most of all, is patience. Now we could pump, we can get a guy on base and hold the ball and come here. If you got peripheral vision, you can see the guy on first base. Robin, when you stand out there and yell, but I stepped off that road and say, jump, you lucky. Because I ain't throwing it to you still.
Who was, we'll go through this real quick now. All the guys behind the plate, as far as umpires are concerned,
okay.
Being a pitcher, obviously it's important to you. Who was your favorite? And then by same token, who was the guy that you really hated to see back
then? Larry Goetz was a great umpire.
Yeah.
Larry Goetz told me early on, because I was, and this is when umpires would talk to, Dusty Bogus was one of my favorite umpires. Lon Warnke was one of my favorite umpires.
Well, he's not a pitcher.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Left-handed pitcher. And I might be telling you something, but what the hell, it doesn't make any difference. Lon Warnke told me, he said, hey, Bubba, he said, we're talking. He said, you know that little crease in your glove? I said, yeah. He said, get yourself a couple of drops of olive oil and put it in there and put the rosin bag on there. I wish I had you at my house. I wish you could see some of these damn pictures. So I did. I got pictures. We used to take, you know, they used to polish our shoes. And in Toronto, I would reach down in here and get the polish here and get the rosin. Now that was Toronto. Lon took me to a new dimension. He said, get the bottle of olive oil and just before you go out there, just put 3 or 4 drops in here and put the rosin bag on there. And I've got pictures that my fingers are black because if a little bit did it, did a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
And my fingers would be so, you're looking for the spin on the ball, and my fingers, I could just about hold the ball right here, the damn ball was hanging onto my fingers. Now, I'm serious, that's not cheating, that's trying to win. But Lon Warnke told me that.
Yeah.
Larry Goetz, I'm pitching in Philadelphia, first time I ever pitched to Larry. He's a good umpire, and he ran a baseball game. I promise you, first time I'd ever pitched to him, and I was coming too far out here, trying to get more on the ball, but I was coming too far out here, and when I'd release the ball, I'd come on over here, and my angle, I think the pitch had that much on the way, but the pitch really was that far outside, and he kept calling the ball. God knows about it. I went in and I started the home plate. And come on, you know, whatever I said, I don't know what I said. I never cussed one of them. But he came out from behind the home plate and he got out there and he said, get back on that mound, you bush son of a bitch, or you're going to be in that clubhouse. And Andy, who was right in front of him, and after he turned around and dusted off, Andy came out and said, hey, don't say anything to this guy. And the next day, umpires, of course I shut up. And the next day, the umpires are out there, and I said, Larry, those pitches were strikes. And he showed me exactly what I said. He said, Bubba, they were outside. He said, you're here, and you're looking at the pitch from out here. He said, stay balanced and stay straightened up and watch the ball in the glove. I said, thank you, Jesus. I mean, really, you can't believe. Now, that was me. That was, Dusty Bodges was just one of the sweetest guys in the world.
Did you have a least favorite ump or somebody that you hated to see behind the plate, somebody that squeezed you a lot?
No. I really didn't. I had Frank Descoli. Larry Getz was a pro. So was Lon Warnke. Lon Warnke was a pitcher. And, oh, God, we had to play at third base in Chicago one time. Lon was coaching third base. My third baseman, I won't name names, but my third baseman in Philadelphia, if a play was coming to third base, and this is third base, my third baseman would be here. My third baseman in Chicago, back here, he leaned over the bag and the guy slid under. And I'm standing right behind him. And I took my glove and I bounced that son of a bitch about that high. I said, you got this son of a bitch. Take the throw, get in front of the bag. That's the way we learn to play. And Lon was the third baseman, and he didn't say anything. I picked up my glove, and when the inning was over, he said, Bo, don't ever do that to me again. He said, you just don't do that. I said, I'm sorry. He said, I understand. I said, don't, with me, umpire, don't do that to me again.
What were some of your favorite hangouts, and what did you guys do in your spare time?
In Philadelphia, we played baseball on Sunday after a doubleheader. We'd go to a place called the CR Club in Philadelphia, take our wives, eat. We went to, hell, I can't remember the name of the places. In Chicago, we didn't do anything. We really did not. We played baseball. Mm-hmm. Chicago was a breeze. You know, play baseball games in the daytime. And then you could have a little time, have a little family life. Kids went to Ivanhoe's in Chicago, and it's just been too long ago.
Yeah. You always had your family with you?
As many and much as I can. They went with me. They were with me.
How about, not to get too personal here, but what was the most money ever made in one year?
$18,000.
What kind of, when you signed with Ben, that he said something, was it $1,500?
$1,500, and he said, you don't want a bonus, because if you get a big enough bonus and all that sort of stuff, you got to be with the ball club.
For 2 years, then, wasn't it?
Within a year, or something like that. And he said, you need experience. You've got to have innings pitched. And it was true. I saw one of the great talents I ever saw in my life signed with the Phillies, $35,000, and they brought him to Toronto right out of high school, and he was just a kid. A great arm. And then he had to go sit on the bench in Philadelphia. And he was out of baseball in 2 or 3 years. And that's what Ben said, you don't want that kind of money. You need innings pitched.
Did you guys get real money back then?
Yeah, I got $2.50 in Class C. Yeah. $250 a month. Got $5 a day in AAA. In Toronto, in the International League, and got $500 a month. We got $5 a day in Toronto in 1949, and got Philadelphia, and we got $11 a day. And I'll tell you what, I won't tell you the names of the ball players, but there's a Netics And there were other things, and a lot of people saved money on meal money.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the ones that were married and had children and what have you. But I would take, in Class C, I had no problem. A guy named Gus Stolis out in Salina, Kansas, still owes me 14 steaks because I made a deal with him. I said, you give people a steak for a home run. I said, I'm a pitcher. Give me a steak for a double, and I can run.
Do you guys talk money amongst yourselves?
Talk
as
money?
Players?
No.
I mean, now everybody knows what everybody else is making.
No. You never, ever. No. You never, ever discussed money.
Did you work in the off season?
No.
No?
I didn't. I was in school. I went to school and had the GI Bill and... oddly enough, that $250 a month, about 4.5 months in 1947, I came home with money, some money, not a lot, but I had the GI Bill. And I went to school, and then $500 a month in Toronto. Well, you know, you live with people, and I bought the first set of golf clubs I ever had in my life in 1948. A guy named Turk Riley was with Wilson Sporting Goods, and the Wilson Sporting Goods furnished all the Philadelphia ball clubs, the big club, and he was a friend of Sawyer's. And Turk said, I said, Turk, can you get me some golf clubs? He said, yeah. I paid $30 for the best leather bag that Wilson made. I paid $51 for the irons, the two through the sand iron and a putter, and I paid $40. Now you, 51, 40 is 91, and $30, got less than $125 in the best set of golf clubs that Wilson made. And then I bought the first shotgun I ever owned in my life for $47 with Ithaca pump. And I duck hunted, and, you know, what the hell? That was all the money in the world you needed. And then, of course, to get married, and I made $5,000, a minimum, and Carpenter gave $2,500. We endorsed Camels, got $2,500 for that, and got $4,700 for losing share of the World Series, so I had a pretty good year.
Yeah.
And everybody I went to high school with were going to school or were teaching and what have you, and one of my best friends who was athletic director at Swanee in Swanee, Tennessee for 25 years said, you son of a bitch, I got an education and I made $350 a month and you making all that kind of money.
Was when you were with Philadelphia, I can't remember the numbers are starting to get mixed up here, but was Connie Mack still with the A's then? Or
yes, I talked to him many, many times.
Well, okay, we got a little bit of side left on this, this side of the tape. Everything you want to talk about Connie Mack about?
Anything about Connie Mack?
Yeah.
He was the epitome of a gentleman. And everything you've ever seen or ever read about him, he knew baseball. And, of course, George Earnshaw, one of our pitching troubleshooters who had pitched for Baltimore, the old Orioles, and pitched for Connie Mack, George Earnshaw was a graduate of Swarthmore and pitched for Connie Mack, big right-hander and all this sort of stuff. And he introduced me to Connie Mack. And I might have been George Earnshaw's protege. I don't know, but... he sat down with me in Salina, Kansas and said, what do you really want? And I told him, and he said, why? And I told him why I wanted it. And he was one of my friends. You know, everybody's got to have a friend. And I had a good year. And he said, I want to see how you throw the curveball. And I've got a picture of George and other pitchers on that Salina pitching staff. And George is saying, throw it this way. And I said, oh, no. I've been throwing it this way all my life. And he said, okay, throw it that way. And I throw it that way for the rest of my life. You know? But you have to have somebody. I think most of all, that you just have to be yourself. And I've had a lot of practice being myself. I ain't gonna change a damn thing in this world. I've lived 71 years and thank God for every minute and every day of it. And yeah, Connie Mack, he's the one that told me two out of the first three pitches for strikes get the decision on 2-2 pitch. And it made sense. Because that way, the name of the game for any pitcher is to try to get the in and out in 10 pitches or less.
Was meeting Connie Mack kind of like meeting Babe Ruth?
Uh-uh. Nothing ever in my life. Nobody in this world has ever had that effect on me that Babe Ruth had on me coming down that third baseline. Connie Mack, I mean, he's a guy you heard about all your life and decimated and just bad health and what have you. And Connie Mack was ramrod straight with his straw hat on and his little collar.
Starch collars.
Starch collar. But he saw everything that happened on the baseball field. And of course, the A's were still in Philadelphia when we got there. And we played the City Series. And it was an A's town when we got there, but it didn't last for about 3 months.